Good evening, this is Gary Kavanagh here on the right side with my friend and colleague. And today, dear listener and Michael, I have a question for you. Oftentimes when we talk of politicians, we can forget the common humanity that binds us, the commonalities that we all share. And Michael, have you ever worked terribly hard for someone and they've turned around and just said it's not good enough, that they've no confidence in you?
Well, truthfully, no. Not that I can think of offhand, or not that I would admit in public anyway. But I should imagine it's very hurtful if it were to happen. It'd be very, very undermining.
Well, I mean, this point would have worked a lot better if you had said yes there, because I would have said, in that case, you should feel a new commonality with Simon Harris, our Minister for Health. Because, Michael, he's tried so hard, but as Linkin Park said, in the end, it didn't even matter. The Consultants Association of Ireland has now voted no confidence in Mr. Harris. Doesn't actually do anything to Harris, because his ability to survive is rather legendary, actually.
Yeah, well, it's tempted to talk about, you know, nuclear holocausts and cockroaches, but we won't. By the way, nice Linkin Park quote there, well done.
I like to mix it up.
Absolutely, well done, well done. Yes, it's a well, if we wanted to be fair and impartial people, and I know we don't, I suppose the question we might ask is, would any minister ever actually be voted confidence by the Irish Hospital Consultants Association? Is that likely? I don't know. Maybe they would. But whatever about the hypotheticals, he has been voted no confidence.
Yes, and for those who are curious what this means, the Irish Hospital Consultants Association is not of particular concern to the government, because no one is of particular concern to the government. But they would basically be the representative group for consultants within Irish hospitals. An association, if you would say. So it's really all in the name. It's rather Ron Seal here. However, they came out and said that Mr. Harris, or Minister Harris, lacks the authority, the understanding, and the inclination to deliver hospital care.
Yeah, whatever about it is, the fact that they're saying he doesn't have the inclination, which is basically saying he's not bothered, that's fairly upsetting. I mean, fairly damning for the poor minister in question, that the consultants union is saying, Minister, see him, you know, see the crisis we have in the hospitals, see the crisis we have in healthcare, yeah, not bothered.
It was also, the motion was also unanimously passed.
Yeah, one hesitates to speculate, but considering the demographics of where these people are on the wage scale of the nation, you have to imagine that one or two of them are Fine Gael voters.
I would imagine. I mean, this is a group that has over, I think it's 3,000 members.
Uh-huh.
Unanimously said the Minister for Health neither has the ability, the understanding, nor the inclination for his job.
Yes, he was shirking his responsibility, they said, to fix the health service. Well, there you go. I suppose we've asked the question before. The tricky thing with Simon is to work out what he has actually done to point to something which is Simon's and just Simon's alone. Now, he can take large portion of credit for the management, I suppose, of the Children's Hospital. But it's still not his. It's still not uniquely his.
Also, you may not want it.
No, I think he's very likely to. Very unlikely to want it. Also, and complacent is the word that was used by a number of people.
Not just complacent, but increasingly complacent.
Mm-hmm.
I did love their quote. And this is the quote from the president of it, Donal O'Hanlon. And he said, after 3 years in the office, he has presided over an unacceptable increase of 153,914 patients on the outpatient waiting list. This amounts to a 37% increase, or an addition of 5 patients every hour.
Yeah, you got to suspect again in this particular group of people that there's quite a few who got an A in honours maths. So they're going to like their numbers, and then actually, it isn't funny at all, because the numbers are dramatic, And the numbers are representative of people who are actually seriously ill, some people who are in very bad pain, and some people are simply dying. I mean, we're talking about, what's the phrase, excess mortality here because of failures within the service.
Absolutely. And I mean, I have drawn up some briefing documents on this over the years. So when I saw the story, I went back and I found an old briefing document I put together in January of last year.
Yeah.
And it is Dr. Tom Ryan, who was the previous president of the IHCA, and the president of the Irish Association of Emergency Medicine, who was Dr. Emily O'Connor. I'm not sure if she's still in her position. And they made the point that there were not enough intensive care beds in hospitals, and that this was leading to a rationing of life-saving surgeries, and explicitly said that this rationing was causing somewhere in the region of 300 totally preventable deaths a year.
Which is not insignificant. 300 people, that's 300 mothers or fathers, 300 brothers or sisters who are no longer in the world because of failures. The figure that stood out for me there, I don't know, for you, was that if we look at the OECD figures for hospital beds, Ireland has 3 hospital beds per 1,000 population. The OECD average is 4.7. That's more than 50%. And Germany is given the example of 8 beds per 1,000. Now, keeping in mind that whatever they say, and they like to play with the figures, the Irish spending on health is very much towards the upper end of the OECD.
The last time I checked, and I haven't looked at this recently because I didn't expect to be talking about the finance of it, was if you take Irish public and private spending, which is government spending, tax spending, and private insurance, and you put them together, we have the second most expensive healthcare system in the OECD, only behind America.
Yeah, there are, depending on how you cut them, some would say only behind the States. Others put us at the top, but slightly behind Denmark, and Denmark behind the United States. But the notion that at the core of the issue is that simply Ireland is behind in its global spending on health is a fallacy. It's just simply not true. We are spending the money, and we're spending it at significant levels within the public sector. And if you look at the spending in the public health sector, there have been significant and consistent increases in that sector, and yet at the same time, the unbudgeted overruns seem to be getting worse.
Well, so far, the HSE is 281 million over budget this year.
Yeah.
I think the year before it was 400 and something million over.
Yeah.
I think it was 490 maybe in 2018.
It was very nearly half a billion euro.
The HSE has a budget of 16 billion euro. There should be no issue with actual spending on the HSE. Actually, sorry, I think our expenditure on it this year was 17 billion on health overall.
The increases have been substantial and have been above the rate of inflation.
I mean, here's a thing, Michael. You could take everything we pay in education, for justice, on transport, and on agriculture together, and you would only spend about the same as what we spend on health. Even the debt servicing and EU payments last year were only about half what we spend on health.
Yeah, no, that's a whole different subject. It shouldn't be, because we should be spending a lot more, and we should have been spending a lot more on getting our debt down, but there, that's another story.
But here's the thing, in 2015, the health budget was 13.3 billion.
Yeah.
In 2019, it was 17.1 billion.
Right.
That is, what, a 3.8 billion euro increase,
yes,
in 4 years?
Over a period where inflation has been almost negligible.
And it hasn't gotten better. It's gotten worse, which would indicate the problem is not financial.
No. Now, we all know that the studies that done in this area are notoriously difficult because they tend to be political, or they tend to be at times done with a view to making a political point. But there does seem to be fairly decent evidence suggesting that a disproportionate amount of this money is going into administration rather than into what we have taken to calling frontline services. In other words, doctors, consultants, nursing, whatever. And this, but that should not surprise us, because we know that when you get a bureaucracy that size, not just in Ireland, this is not an Irish problem, but all over the world, bureaucracies like this breed themselves, they replicate themselves, they develop this capacity to absorb money. Administrators naturally think that if you have a problem, what you need is more administration, more and better administration. That's what we need. Civil servants, if you ask them, they'll tend to think, well, what this needs is better management. So we need more and better managers in the civil service. You will get the answer depending on who you the answer you want depending on who you ask. But we are certainly not getting proportionate increases in outcomes and increases in productivity proportionate to the amounts of money that the extra amounts of money that are going in. In fact, I think it's fair to say that since in the last 4 years, we've seen an accelerating decline in the outcomes and the productivity and the increase in the problems against the backdrop of significant increases in income.
No, and I think the question here is, and we've been talking about the idea of confidence in Simon Harris, if it's not political, if it's not financial, it's structural and political.
Yes.
Which will require politicians to lead a change on it.
It'll require politicians and it will require policy. Now, the big policy idea that is floating around is the SláintecAir.
Which is not a policy.
But it's really not. But it's worse than being wrong, in a sense, Gary, because I think that in Dáil Éireann and anybody who's looked at it in the health service, everybody agrees that it's never going to be implemented. No, maybe little bits of it will
be. It's got all of the good things of where we want. People shouldn't be in hospitals. They should be dealing with GPs and we should be focused on preventative care.
And all
of the good things that we've been saying for decades. And how much will that cost? Well, we don't know. And how will we achieve it? Well, we don't know yet.
They've completely avoided putting any figures on it. But when people try and put figures on it, what the answer is lots and lots of money.
But do you remember how SláintecAir was created?
Sorry?
Do you remember how SláintecAir was created?
Well, I would say in the back of an envelope, essentially. There was a policy vacuum. Initially, O'Reilly, if you remember, when he was Minister of Health, he went around touting, along with Andy Kenny, the Dutch model. And the Dutch model was going to be the great saviour. Now, as it turned out, the Dutch model was itself almost bankrupt and is limping along as we speak. Somehow, somewhere, the Dutch model got abandoned and the policy vacuum was created, and into which SláintecAir grew. Now, what do you mean by the precise circumstances?
Well, this wasn't something that Fine Gael just created. This is something that a lot of the Irish political parties had a hand in.
Yeah.
I believe it was actually a cross-party policy.
But it's a wish list, it's not a policy.
Well, that's the problem. It was, you brought together all of the Irish political parties and you said, look, this is an incredible issue, we need to focus on one thing and we'll all agree on it, and then we can fix the health service because we've all agreed on it, so there's no political cost to doing this because there's no alternative. And then they came back with SláintecAir.
What this represents, and it's is ultimately a lack of political courage. And an unwillingness that not just Fine Gael politicians, but politicians across the board have, is an unwillingness to publicly admit that they got something not only wrong, but dramatically wrong. And they're going to incur costs, significant costs, to undo something which they had done. And money that was just simply going to be involved in deconstructing the mistake. That's not going to happen. I remember 2-3 years ago, you were talking to people who had been involved in the process of actually setting up the HSE, and a number of people were working within the HSE, both clinically and at administrative level. And the constant response you were getting, if I remember correctly, was, this is not just broken, it's irreparably broken. This does not fix This does not. There is no fix available for this. This is irretrievable. We need to knock it down and start again.
Yeah, I talked to some of the people who had designed and implemented the HSE, and it ranged from it's totally unsalvageable to sort of lean back, look at ceiling, laugh slightly, and go, well, maybe it could be fixed. But I actually think the Slonczyker report was, it was a chance. It came from the Committee on the Future of Healthcare.
Yeah.
And it was a chance for all of the political parties in Ireland to come together on an issue that is politically very difficult to move on, because for all people talk about how it is a bloated administration, and it absolutely is, there's also issues with staffing, there's issues with consultants, there's issues with everything. And whoever fixes the issue is going to have some deeply unpopular people. So this was a chance for everyone to come together and everyone to agree on one plan so that it could actually be implemented. And instead of doing that, they went into total fantasy and came back with something that was largely unpriced. And, I mean, it made some recommendations. I think it said we'd spend $3 billion over the next 6 years and we'll get it. And then people looked at it and went, well, maybe $6 to $7 billion.
And maybe 4 or 5 years.
And, oh.
Yeah. There are health systems. There is no such thing as a perfect health system. There's no perfect healthcare anywhere in the world. But there are certainly systems which seem to work much, much better than ours and which don't cost more than ours. Now, there may be issues where you're talking about systems which have a lot more sunk capital, which have pre-existing structures that we don't have. There are structures that we need to construct that maybe that incur costs that they don't have. I don't know. But certainly systems like the Swiss system, the French system, the Italian system, the Swiss system is generally regarded as the best. But I think at this stage people would happily take with the Italian system, the French, the German, even the Spanish system, anything. I think we'd probably say no thanks to the NHS.
It is weird. The British really love the NHS, but when you look at the actual results it delivers, they're not good.
No, but I think that a sociologist once said to me that the NHS in the United Kingdom has replaced the Church of England as being the national religion.
Actually, here's something just to tell you how seriously the Slonczyker report was considered at the time. Do you remember who was the chairwoman of the committee?
The chairman of the... No, I don't. Sorry.
So this... Let's see if you can guess this, Michael. It was a committee to design the future of the Irish healthcare system, something which presidents of Consultants Union of Emergency Medical Practitioners have come out and said is openly killing people.
Right.
So who would you put in... This is clearly a woman because I said chairwoman. Who would you put in control of something like that?
Well, I can think there are two obvious candidates. One is Catherine Noon, the other would be Mary Mitchell O'Connor. I don't know which. Why? Who did we have?
Roisin Shortall.
No. Actually, Roisin Shortall. I've a modicum of time for Roisin, and she's. I mean, not that much, obviously, but there's worse in the dole than Roisin.
Yeah. But she did produce Slonczyker, so I don't have that much time
for it. Yeah, exactly. You should judge them by their fruits, I suppose.
Yeah, it's very easy to look back and go, no, that was not a good idea.
It's all right. Okay, I'm putting you on the spot, and I'm sure you won't care because you won't answer if you don't want to.
I mean, if I really wanted, I could just edit this entire section out.
Indeed, but... What direction do you think we should be going in? I mean, the classic response for your free market conservative would be that we need more competition in the market. We need to free it up. We need to cut down on the cartels, break up the monopolies, break up the stranglehold that the medical associations have, say, for example, on the training of doctors, which creates an artificial limit on the number of doctors going through.
I would say with the Irish healthcare system, I'll be as fair as possible with this, you could go either to the left or the right and improve it. I don't think the difficulty with the Irish health service is fundamentally ideological. I think I would prefer it would go to the right. I think it would work better would it go to the right, but it could go to the left. But you would need to do certain things that actually require commitment to public service in a way that we don't have in this country.
What do you mean by that? What, the commitment to public service?
Well, for instance, the health service is not a job programme.
Okay, yeah. Well, and that is a mistake that people tend to make in Ireland. And it's not just Ireland. That when the state is involved at any stage, whether it's in the healthcare or whether it's in subsidised factories producing fertiliser or shoes or whatever the hell it might be, that they become ultimately perceived as job problems. You can't shut that down because so many jobs will be lost. Yes, but it's not doing the job that it's supposed to. Yeah, but still, you know, people, so many jobs will be lost.
Look, just take the administrators and move them to a work programme digging roads somewhere.
Okay. I can't imagine that's going to improve the roads programme very much. But
no, and I don't imagine they'd like it either. But if they don't like it, they can quit.
Anyway, the point being, 3 years in the job, a lot done, a lot more to do, and Minister Harris has now lost the confidence of the consultants.
It is perhaps telling that where we had intended to talk about Simon Harris and how bad of a job he had done, we simply talked about something, an actual policy that he actually didn't really have any part in playing. Because when you actually look at what Simon Harris has done, and his impact on his department, he's basically not there. There's not a lot to criticise because there's just not a lot there.
There are two tremendously cynical things I've heard people observe about Harris in the job. First of all, noting the fact that he is now 3 years in the job, which is, relatively speaking, a long time to be left in the same place.
Mm.
And there's no sign that he's going to be moved out of it. That this is the first, number one cynical comment is that he's been left there because, well, he might as well take all the shit for it anyway, because since we have no more ideas on what to do if we take him out and give somebody else, why ruin two careers when we can only ruin one, and we don't really like him anyway, so leave him in there for another year and then dump him so he can act as a lightning rod. And the other thing is, maybe that he's actually being rewarded because of his successful role in the repeal of the 8th and the perception that he was important in its success. And I know that he did garner huge admiration amongst people within the Together for Yes campaign, that he was regarded very, very highly by them. Which or whether neither should be a good reason to leave somebody who has been so spectacularly incompetent in the job and in such an important job. Whatever the reasons are, he is yet there and there is no sign of him moving and there's no sign of him doing anything. So no, we may put up with it.
His stasis is actually quite impressive. Because as I said, when I went back trying to find things he's done, he's talked about a fair bit of things. But when you actually look at what's been implemented, it's like a Micheál Martin situation, where you just keep eventually going, smoking ban?
Well, Micheál would suggest that he did actually do things. Brian Cowan, and I know that people might be that sympathetic towards this, there was a certain refreshing honesty to Cowan's attitude to health, which was very clear. I'm doing nothing, and I just want to get out here. He called it Angola not because of the desperate poverty of it, but rather it was so full of landmines that everywhere you stepped, you risked on stepping on a landmine which could potentially end your career. So he said his position was, which is not even actually fair, because he did do one thing. Whether or not he practically achieved anything, one of his big issues, at least as a bully pulpit, was to establish the importance or the equality of the importance of mental health and people with intellectual disability within the system, because he felt that one of the problems in healthcare has been historically those people, that there are certain groups that have more effective lobby groups and are more, shall we say, more attractive to the media, that tend to get more money, get more attention, and therefore get more money, and that he felt that that was something that had to be corrected. And he maybe did something towards that. But Simon has talked a good game, but done nothing.
I can't even get annoyed at his ineptitude anymore, because it is so constant consistent.
You're just not trying if you can't get annoyed.
I mean, there was a moment during the week when he was in the papers complaining about people trying to come and talk to him about vaping and how he would never meet these people. And you sort of have to go, well, vaping substantially better for people than smoking, as Britain is leaning into. Maybe you may want to meet with some of these people. Maybe the fact that some of them are industry linked is not something that should be a red line for you.
You know, we live in a
he's just not a serious person. None of these are serious people.
A serious person would recognize that one of the principal problems that we increasingly live with in this in our politics is the fact that we live in more and more in bubbles. And a minister who actually explicitly says, I am not interested in hearing the opinions or the arguments of one side of this. Just not interested. I'm not going to hear them. I'm not going to listen to them. I'm only going to listen to the people from the other side. And then I'm going to formulate policy on that. That's beyond a joke. That's so unserious.
He did that during the abortion referendum. And I think most people, the pro-life didn't expect it and the pro-choice were happy about it. But it seems to be something he applies to everything he does. And he'll just go, I already know what I think. I don't need to meet other people who might have information I haven't considered.
I know what I think. I don't know why I think it, but that doesn't matter.
I feel it very strongly in my gut.
Jeez, I feel it. Anyway, he might do well to consider a little bit more of an evidence-based approach, like the kind of thing that's coming out of the pain clinic, for example, which I thought was a rather interesting story.
Yes, I mean, it's a fascinating little story, and we'll end on something a bit lighter.
A bit funny.
Well, actually, it's not possible to be lighter than Simon Harris's career.
Okay, that's Simon Harris put in his place.
This is just the one. That's the one that'll just bring him down.
That's the one that'll topple him.
So, it's a pain clinic in Dublin has come out, and they've been talking about, well, actually more exactly, they were neurosurgeons at Beaumont Hospital, talked about a study that hadn't been published, and it was a study of 100 patients in the Mater Hospital, in the pain management service. And, Michael, now you might be shocked by this fact, and I know the listener will be, because it's incredibly difficult to, you know, when you see something and you just go, that just doesn't make sense. But it's this. More than 90% of patients with whiplash attending a Dublin pain management clinic fail to return for any additional treatment once their legal action was completed. Michael, these people are in pain. They're on the streets in pain with their settlements.
It's possible, Gary, that we actually have discovered something very important medically, something that neuroscientists all over the world should, that going to the High Court can actually cure soft tissue injury.
I mean, Michael, you say that, but in the article they're talking about what happens to people who suffer whiplash injuries in sport and who don't take legal action. Yes. They recover in 6 to 12 weeks. And then from there on out. In contrast, however, people who take their cases to the High Court, they have pain that can last years, Michael. They could be prescribed opiates and pain medicine. They may even suffer early post-traumatic stress disorder. They're at risk of addiction, PTSD, MRIs, pain management treatment. They could lose their job, suffer family distress, become addicted to opiates. And the very least the court can do, I mean, once all that's happened, is to richly reward them. Well, not even richly reward them, but to compensate them for that suffering through the medium of grossly inflated payouts. And then I think it's the money. I think it's not the money, but, you know, the knowledge that you've finally been vindicated, your pain, and then it dissipates very quickly at a time when, through pure chance, you've gotten quite a great deal of money.
It lifts like a morning dew. To me the one that sticks out here is the line where that people who suffer whiplash injuries in sport, which are generally speaking not vindicated in the courts, or who do not take legal action, recover in 6 to 12 weeks. I like the fact that because of the way it's it's the kind of report it's in, that it sounds like this is a medically significant fact. Mm. It's like, are people who had gene marker X31 or people who had very high levels of cod liver oil consumption or something, people who do not take legal action, recover in 6 to 12 weeks, in contrast, people taking cases suffer a perfect storm, that's inverted in quotes, due to protracted litigation that can last for years. And as you say, opiates, pain medicines, early post-traumatic stress disorder, it's just a nightmare.
Absolutely. Now,
is it simply because, Gary, the more serious injuries end up in court, and that's really what's happening? Or are you suggesting some kind of shenanigans is going on?
I wouldn't say anything about that. I mean, I would say, you know, in countries like Germany, Greece, Lithuania, Italy, where you're generally not going to get compensation for whiplash, most people recover in a couple of days. However, my theory is this, Michael. That's not proof that there are a great deal of Irish people seeking to milk the system because they know it's absolutely ineffective. Doctors will sign off on nearly anything, and we give awards multiple times higher than our neighbours. I think it shows that there is a genetic weakness in the back and the muscular structure of Irish people, which gives us a proneness to whiplash that is duly reflected in our legal arrangements, and fairly, I would say.
In contrast, in Lithuania, which obviously is a different genetic profile to us, where possibilities for gain are minimal in the case of whiplash, a study of 202 people involved in rear-end collisions showed that none had persistent and disabling complaints 1 to 2 years later, and another study of 210 people showed symptoms disappeared in most cases after a few days. It's also curious that, and maybe this is reflective of the structural skeletal problems that the Irish people have, that awards are 3 times higher than in the United Kingdom and 5 times higher than in continental Europe.
Well, I mean, we've got to, you know, the legal system has to reflect the decreased quality of life amongst the Irish when this happens, I think is absolutely fair. I think we should look at this. And we should worry about these people who, 90% of whiplash people who just stop attending their pain management clinic as soon as their legal case is over. I mean, these are people in pain, Michael, and they're on the street, possibly high on opiates.
I genuinely,
whatever medical this, care, it's just
whoever wrote this is just it was having some fun. Put it that way. Irish doctors who regularly assess, there's two interesting points here, to regularly assess patients for whiplash injuries, point out that engineering reports prepared for court cases frequently question the severity of symptoms following whiplash injuries, particularly where accidents occur at a roundabout with slowing speeds varying between 5 to 10 kilometres an hour. I've mentioned to you before, Gary, and I think I've mentioned on the podcast before that recently in Italy, they've worked out using all sorts of sciencey, medically things, that this kind of injury does not occur where the impact occurs below a certain speed or where the impact occurs below a certain pace, a certain force. And because of the computers and all the telemetry that you have in modern cars, you can take the readings from the cars and say, okay, it's below this level, and you just can't claim for a whiplash. So, for example, if you had an accident 5 to 10K in Italy, I think you might have to go whistle. But you have to enjoy this. This is a quote. Equally mystifying is the absence of injury to rear-ending driver despite the impact of equal and opposite forces. Now, it's a fairly new... I think they're saying that it is a Newtonian event when you have one car rear-ending another, so that there are equal and opposite reactions. So the person in front gets whipped. It's a curious thing that, like I said, this is actually a quote, equally mystifying. And you have this picture of this researcher, this doctor, this new researcher going, what could possibly be the cause of this strange thing that the driver who rear-ends the person who is being sued, and obviously can't sue anybody, does not have any injuries. He is absent of injury. It's almost like this is a piece of medical science which is being written with sort of in italics with quotes around it for the Onion. It's really well. He had good fun. Whoever wrote it.
Do you think it's a problem though? It's not only an area where there's a great deal of fraudulent claims, but everyone knows there's fraudulent claims, and there are more fraudulent claims than there are amongst Italians. I mean, that's my high point for just general public corruption, Italy. If you're doing something you shouldn't be doing at a higher rate than the Italians, it's time to scale that way back.
I don't think the fact... Okay, we all believe that we know that this is happening, that these fraudulent claims are being made, and they're being made on a large scale. I don't think that any of us are in a position to be able to point to that person and say... unless we have particular information, it's very hard for us to say you're fraudulent, you're not, or you're all fraudulent, or you're slightly less, and maybe you should get less money. But there is a fundamental problem in the system, and it is really tedious when you see a report like this and you see the figures regarding the payments and you see the levels of fraud that appear to be going on, and then at the same time, you have politicians coming out and bashing the insurance companies and saying that the problem in Ireland regarding insurance is simply because there's a cartel of people out there and they're all setting prices. And they're making all this money and this vast profits.
Yeah.
And we have to chase them up.
Yeah, I think this is an incredibly complicated area, and I'm not going to say I have an understanding or a perfect understanding of exactly how to fix this area. I will say, the fact that foreign insurance firms either refuse to get involved in Irish markets or are trying to get out of them as quickly as they can would indicate to me that this is not a healthy market to be in general.
Well, yeah, and it's not just cars.
It's everything.
It's across the board. I've quoted before my friend Laura, who was the chief claims negotiator in Europe for an American insurance company. And she said to me, and we're talking, geez, this is more than just 20 years ago, and I don't think things have got better. Her company had been in Ireland. They'd looked at it and thought, oh God, how little competition there was, and there was still going to be decent opportunities to do business. They got in, and I think within 5 years, they were getting out as quickly as they could. And she said that she thought that Americans were litigious until she had to deal with the Irish. And that's kind of bad. You're taking the Italians as sort of peak corruption level, but I think we traditionally would say look to the United States for peak litigation. And when an American litigation lawyer with an insurance company says to you, we're more litigious than the United States, we maybe have a problem.
It's just so undignified as well. Yes, you'll make some money, but I mean, have a little bit of self-respect.
It's like a form of the tragedy of the commons, because nobody ultimately, or the people, a large number of people, don't ultimately realize that there is a resource here, which is a common resource, which is actually being abused, which has a consequence for the wider population, which means that we are paying much higher levels of insurance, both car insurance and other kinds of insurance, than we should be. We are now moving into a scenario, we've talked about this before, where there are going to be traditionally held outdoor events, whether they're church fetes or cake sales or bake sales or parties or fetes or whatever, that are simply not going to happen because the insurance costs have got so high. But it's not just that the insurance costs have got so high. These are the kinds of events which, in other countries, they wouldn't actually take out a public liability insurance because they wouldn't consider it was necessary. They would have a certain kind of cover, which they would get from, say, a local government figure, because they were doing something which was a community activity, and they would get a certain level of cover from that. Here, people are constantly aware that you could be sued, somebody could sue the hell out of you for slipping on a grape and falling on their arses, and that could ruin you. You could be bankrupt. so that these opportunities exist, and they simply don't exist in other places, and therefore these problems don't exist.
I think we just need to shame people more.
We might. It might be that, or it might be that we need to pursue fraudulent claims more vigorously, and people who are engaged in fraudulent activity may have to be dealt with by the penal system.
You say we can't just look at people and say, you're fraudulent and you're not. I'd give you a solid bet if you go down to some of the courts, you could have a better than random chance of picking out who would have a fraudulent claim. I think if you just say yes to all of them, you're onto a winner.
Yeah. As the House of Cards would say, you could say that, I couldn't possibly comment. You may be right. We wouldn't want to throw babies out with bathwater, but I think that this is a case where there's a hell of a lot of bathwater and not that much baby.
I don't know if that was the image you wanted to go with. I think you want one whole baby or two whole, nothing in between.
It's a very small baby.
I don't think you ever want a not that much baby phrase. Like, what percentage of a baby? What's happened to it?
Yeah, but rather.
At that point, you probably do want to throw the whole thing out because that one's been ruined.
Let's make another one. Yes, I think maybe we'll leave that there on that stylistic note. I think that we should abandon that one. Anyway.
We will be back on Wednesday talking about the budget. The white paper is out already, but we thought we would mercifully spare others from having to talk about it. It'll probably be, I suspect it will be a very boring budget, but there'll probably be a couple of things that are worth paying attention to. And it'll also, the great thing is because we're doing it right before Brexit, it may never happen.
It'll be boring. You probably, are you too young to remember, but there was a time when budgets were surprises, and that the absolutely biggest sin that you could commit as either a politician or a civil servant was to leak anything from a budget.
Yes, and was that the days when governments were governments as opposed to the remnants of a colonial bureaucracy cut off from the homeland and thus with no idea what it should actually be doing?
Well, cut off from the homeland and run by two subpar PR firms. But yes, that is the time I am referring to. It really seriously was. It was that if you were caught with a whiff of a budget, bang, you were gone. It was a capital offence. By these days, by the time he gets up in the doll, everybody can basically has worked out what the changes to their pensions are going to be. Anyway, we shall be back on Wednesday to discuss said things. And until then, we wish you a good week.
All the best.
And bye-bye.